Good evening and welcome to the Dhamma Talk. The title this evening I have unashamedly borrowed from Krishnamurti. And the title is, we'll translate it in a moment.
Just a minute.
Yes.
Go. Thank you.
Sorry.
And the title is A Pilgrimage of Inquiry from Which There Is No Return. A Pilgrimage of Inquiry from Which There Is No Return.
מסע עלייה לרגל של חקירה ממה שאין ממנו חזרה.
Yes. This is our inquiry. So there is no return from our pilgrimage of inquiry. Because once we have seen and understood the Dhamma teaching, our relationship to the whole of life is forever changed. We cannot go back. I'm sorry, it's too late to go back.
We'll go home.
So once we see that in this life there is suffering, there's the causes of suffering, there's the end of suffering or the cessation of it, even in small ways. Once we see that, our relationship, the way we live, is altered. It's different. We have that awareness. The Buddha says this about it. He says, just as the river Ganges inclines towards the sea, slopes towards the sea, flows towards the sea, and merges with the sea. So too, Master Gotama's assembly, so the men and women who were with the Buddha, with its homeless ones and its householders, that's us, inclines towards Nibbana, slopes towards Nibbana, flows towards Nibbana, and merges with Nibbana. So once we step into the river of the Dhamma, once we enter that stream, we flow towards the sea of freedom. So if we practice, having heard the Dhamma, our practice irrevocably frees up our life. I don't know anybody who practices the Dhamma who is not more free than when they began. And sometimes the insights come rather suddenly, as you might have discovered. Sometimes the insights come rather gradually. And it could be that after a year or so of practice, we look back and we think, oh, I can see now how I used to be, how I behaved before, with my family, my wife, my mother, my father, my friends. And we can see the shift and the change. So it could be that the freedom comes rather dramatically and suddenly. This does occur. There can be an understanding that's dramatic and sudden, after which the relationship to all life is different. Or, of course, there's the combination. Sometimes we practice a lot. We do really deep, long retreats, or we come to a retreat and have some profound experience. And then after that, we reflect and we begin to understand the experience. And the experience needs to deepen within us. until we live and see and know the truth of it. Until our life reflects our understanding. At this point, I want to tell a story, of course. There was a woman named Rachel who came to the Bodh Gaya retreats in India a few years ago now. And she lived and worked in Bhutan. She was English, but she lived in Bhutan, to the north of India. And the landscape, of course, in Bhutan is very mountainous, and there were not many roads. And so she told me a story of what happened to her when she was coming to the retreat, or she was traveling in Bhutan. She was in a car with three people, and a driver. So there were four people altogether traveling in the car. The road was along the edge of a cliff. So the road was actually blasted out of hard rock. I saw something like this going to Jerusalem, where there's incredibly hard rock. And in this stretch of road, which is only 10 kilometers long, there are 2,000 people employed to move the rocks by hand. Because there are so many rock falls. And now you know what's going to happen. So she said, there we were, driving along the road. And suddenly in front of us, there was a rock fall. And the road was impassable. Completely impassable. And then, behind, a huge avalanche. And the road fell away. So there they were. They couldn't go forward, and they couldn't go back. The road behind was completely gone, and there was just a sheer drop into the valley. Oh, I'm getting goosebumps talking about it. Just a sheer drop. And she said she also couldn't stay still. Because more rocks were falling. So she said it was the most frightening experience of her whole life. And she had no idea what to do. And then suddenly all four of them leapt out of the car and began moving the rocks ahead. So one by one they had to pick up the rocks and throw them into the valley. So, isn't this sometimes like our life? We reach an impasse. Isn't this like the Dharma path? We reach an impasse in our life. We don't know how to go forward. We can't see the way. It feels like it's blocked. But we know we can't go back. Because the road behind has fallen away. So sometimes things happen in our life. There are huge events. Someone we love dies. A relationship ends. Our mother or father die. Or we have a big financial loss. So sometimes there's huge events in life. We can't go back to how life was because the path behind has fallen away. And we have to go forward, but we don't know how. And so I said to Rachel, what did you do? And she said, I grabbed each rock in my hands like this and I threw it into the abyss. So sometimes, of course, the rocks that seem to be in the way are the rocks of our compulsions, the rocks of our fears, the rocks of our desires. The rocks of our anger, for example. These are the things that seem to be blocking our way forward. These are the things that seem to obscure our freedom. So sometimes in front of us, we see the many difficulties. We look at our life and we go, oh, I'm not very compassionate. We look at our life and we feel filled with self-hatred. We don't like ourselves. Or we look at someone else and we don't like them. And so we can be filled with all sorts of judgmental ideas. Sometimes we can feel aggressive, angry, violent. And these obstacles, we'll call them, seem to obscure our freedom and seemingly prevent us going forward on the Dharma path. However, the Dharma path is really to look and see with mindfulness at all of these things, to inquire into what are the causes and conditions that produce my self-hatred? How did this come about? To see into it, to understand the process of mind. And then, with mindfulness, without hanging on to anything, non-clinging mind, we pick up our obsessiveness and let it go. We pick up our anger, perhaps, and let it go. We pick up our wanting mind with our mindfulness, the metaphor, and we let it go into the abyss. So sometimes we see there's no going back, and the road ahead needs lots of attention. We need to move some obstacles before we can go further forward. This is our Dharma path. This is the practice. And this is what we need to do. When the obstacles are removed, of course, there appears before us that which is free, that which is unbound, that which is unproblematic. So we walk the path to freedom, and we can do it step by step by looking at all the areas of our life, our speech, our livelihood, our view, our action, the way we relate to others, by cultivating kindness, love, friendship, warmth, generosity, all of these things. They're life-changing. And when we do that, it's our freedom that's revealed. Punjaji said, the boulders are big rocks. The boulders of the past rest on your chest and destroy your life and freedom. Remove them by finding the origin of the I thought. So remove them by finding the origin of the I thought.
Cool.
Freedom waits, but most are engaged with something else. So our pilgrimage of inquiry, our journey of inquiry, is to see and know for ourselves the freedom that's revealed. When we see the origin of the I thought, we see where the I rests and lands, we track it. And the I thought can land on any of the aggregates form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness without clinging. It can rest so lightly that there's a taste of freedom, the touch of freedom, and the depth of freedom. So when we let go, when we really just let go of our compulsions, obsessions, our habits of mind, our desires, our identity, our concepts, our thoughts about who we should be and how we should be, when we just let it go, there's a wonderful, extraordinary freedom that's revealed. So let's come to Krishnamurti and what he said about this. Krishnamurti speaks very eloquently about the quality of aloneness. This doesn't mean loneliness, but aloneness as in solitude. And Krishnamurti, of course, uses slightly different language from the language of the Buddha. So just see if you can catch the meaning. He says, the mind that has entered upon a pilgrimage of inquiry from which there is no return, that is, inquiring not only now, during this hour, but from day to day. Such a mind will have discovered a state of creation which is all existence. It is what you call truth or God. For that to take place, there must be complete aloneness. An aloneness in which there is no attachment, no companionship, either of words or thoughts or memories. So you see, some of the language is slightly different, but you can catch the meaning. It's precious. He says, it is a total denial of everything which the mind has invented for its own security. This is worth some inquiry. This is worth reflection. And then he starts to describe what he means. The complete aloneness in which there is no fear has its own extraordinary beauty. It is a state of love because it is not the aloneness of reaction. It is a total negation which is not the opposite of the positive. So in other words, he is describing the love which has no opposite. And Dharma teachings, of course, also point to this. The Buddha said, truth is one without a second. So, truth has no opposite. The truth that's being pointed to. And in the Dharma, very often, how it's taught is through negation. We say what freedom is not. We say it's not self. So this method of communicating is perhaps at first hard to understand. And the Buddha said lots of things in these terms. Freedom is referred to also as the unborn, the undying, the unconditioned. So you see it's referred to in a negative way, saying what it is not, but not saying a whole lot about what it actually is, because it is no thing or object that we can grab hold of and say, this is mine. We need to see for ourselves. We need to shine the light for ourselves. Be a light unto ourselves. Ajahn Buddhadasa, the great teacher of emptiness from Thailand, says this on the subject. Total emptiness or freedom is called Nibbana. The condition of emptiness resulting from the complete and thorough elimination of the self-idea is Nibbana. This can be summarized by saying, Nibbana is supreme emptiness. Supreme emptiness is Nibbana. It is that unique vision that transcends ordinary knowledge. So it's to see in a way that isn't bound to the personal self. When I, me, and my cease, freedom's revealed. The liberation isn't personal. So over the days here, you've been invited to make your own pilgrimage of inquiry, journey of inquiry. And some of you have rather bravely come to the front and inquired with me. I thank you for that, because it's precious for all of us to hear. On one of the retreats in Australia, where I taught the same instructions as we used here, the instructions from the Anapanasati Sutta, a woman who'd done many retreats before, a woman who was asked to breathe in experiencing joy and breathe out experiencing joy, immediately on appearing, on hearing that, said to herself, I can't do that, I can't do that. And her mind went immediately to, I know I should never have come. I should never have come to this retreat. It always happens like this. I get here and then I don't want to be here. And I can't do it. I can't experience joy. This was her thought. She told me all about it. So that was her immediate reaction. And she thought, oh, here we go again. Radha's talking about freedom. And I can't understand. But bless her heart, she didn't leave. After the meditation, she got up and she walked over to the side of the hall. And outside was the beautiful rainforest, and the window was open. And a really light breeze just touched her cheek. And in that moment of feeling just the touch of the light breeze on her face, she felt wonderful sensations in her face. And the beautiful sensations, she said, spread to her entire body. And suddenly she found herself filled with joy. Because in that moment, she had not resisted the simplicity of the sensation of the breeze on her face. She had just been totally with her own direct experience. And in the sensitivity of that that comes with the meditation experience, she felt the joy flood through her body, challenging all of her beliefs of, I can't do this, I can't be free, I can't experience joy. And the next day she came to tell me what had happened. So I said, talking with her in the interview, I said, just do it now. Do it again. Just breathe in joy. Breathe out joy. And she did. And she said, oh, Radha, I can feel it in my fingertips. I can just feel it. So if you are a person who experiences a lot of negativity or a lot of thoughts that say, I can't do this, or if the sense of I lands on I'm not free, or I can't meditate, then this practice is for you. So please, if this is your struggle in the meditation hall, or if joy is not something that you feel a lot of in your life, then this is a precious practice. It's a beautiful way to meditate, because there's a natural joy that starts to flood through the body when we just get in touch with our intuitive, natural awareness that we as human beings all have, all can do. We all know it. And to come back to the Buddha's text, this is slightly complicated, I'm sorry. Whatever exists therein of material form, feeling, perception, formations and consciousness, he or she sees those states as impermanent, as suffering. And then he goes on to say, as a disease, as a tumor, as a barb, so like something sharp, as an affliction, as void, so as empty, as not self. So there's much encouragement to see this mechanism of mind, to cling to any of the aggregates, to really see them, to see that process as not self. And then we start to see the death of all that we have put together with the mind. We start to see for ourselves the death of all of our mental formations and constructions, all our views of ourselves, all our ideas about how we are, how we should be, what we're not. And if we can just let that go, freedom shines forth, freedom bursts forth. We can see it just for ourselves, even if we're still just for a minute or even 30 seconds. If we just see it, just a glimpse, just a taste, and reflect on it, we'll know for ourselves the truth of things. And then in the text, the Buddha asks us to turn our mind away from the difficult states and direct our attention towards the deathless. And you might say, what on earth is that? He says, he tells us, this is the peaceful. This is the sublime. That is the stilling of all formations. So the making still of all ideas we have about ourselves. The relinquishment of all attachments. So the letting go of all attachments and clinging. The exhaustion of craving. Dispassion, cessation, nibbana. sometimes when we don't let go of something, it can be rather dangerous. I want to tell you about a situation with my brother. My big brother is some 12 years older than me. He always sees himself as the big brother and I'm the little sister. He unfortunately had an accident in his house. He just tripped backwards, hit his head on the wall, and ended up having a brain hemorrhage. This was partly due to the fact that he took a medication because prior to this he'd had a stroke. So just the hit on the head meant that he was hemorrhaging, and I was called to the hospital saying that he was likely to die before morning. So we arrived at the hospital, my sister-in-law, his son and myself. I arrived somewhat later because I live a little way away and I had to drive through an amazing storm to get there. I arrived at the hospital, and by the time I arrived, he was actually in surgery. They decided that they couldn't just let him die. They said to him, if we do surgery, you might die. But if we don't do surgery, you will die before morning. And guess what his response was? He said, oh, that's pretty grim. Pretty grim.
They're goom.
And so he'd gone in for this surgery, but the surgeons didn't really hold out much hope that he would live. He did. But then, of course, he was in intensive care in the hospital. And the intensive care units have, you know, machines and tubes and things everywhere. So there he was, completely hooked up to machines. He was on life support. At night, they would put him into an intentional coma. So they'd drug him so that he would sleep. And then in the daytime, they'd try and bring him out of it a little bit to see how conscious he was, to see what damage, to see whether he had brain damage or what was happening. And at this stage, we had no idea whether he would live or die, and if he lived, what state he would be in, whether he would be able to move his hands or legs or speak or not. So it was a dramatic situation. And so my sister-in-law and I and my nephew took turns to be with him by the bed, along with all of the hospital staff. And this evening, my sister-in-law was exhausted, so I said, look, I'll stay with him until he goes to sleep. You go home. It just happened to be that the nurses were changing shift. And my brother became quite agitated, and he kept trying to pull the tubes out of his nose and throat. Now, if he pulled them out, he just would have died then and there. So what they did was they tied his hands to the bed. Okay, so here he is. He's in hospital, all these things. His hands are tied to the bed. But of course, he figured he could do a sit-up and reach the tubes with his hands. And so there was I, and the staff said, look, we're just changing shift. Can you just stay with him? And you'll have to stop him from pulling the tubes out. So there I was. And then I was literally fighting him. I was leaning across the bed with all my weight. And he's a big guy. And he was somehow filled with this incredible strength. And finally I said, Peter, his name's Peter. I said, Peter, do you want to die? Because I thought, maybe he's telling me, I don't want this. This is it. I'm over it. I don't want to stay here anymore. I want to die. And he shook his head. No, I don't want to die. So I thought, what is going on? And so there I was, and I was actually there for 45 minutes fighting him, holding his hands down and saying, "Stop it, don't do this. If you pull these tubes out, you will die. You just told me you don't want to." And so I could see that he understood. And then, finally, to my relief, along came a nurse. And she looked at him and she went, "Peter, stop that right now." There he was. An angel. He just stopped. And I looked at him and I thought, here he is, 45 minutes of fighting. And I suddenly, it dawned on me. He thinks he's my big brother. I'm the little sister and he doesn't have to do what I say. Even if it means he's going to die. So here he was. He's clinging to this role. If I don't have to take any notice of her because she's my little sister. He's much older and wiser and knows best, of course. But clinging to that nearly cost him his life. I mean, he was a little bit drugged from all the drugs as well. But it wasn't until this fierce nurse with the voice of authority just told him off that he was angelic. He just, I thought, my goodness. If you recover, I'm going to have something to say about this. And thankfully he did recover. And he had to learn to talk again and walk again. But now he's even driving again. And it's extraordinary what the body can actually do and recover from. So, sometimes when we cling to a role, cling to something, we can really put ourselves in some kind of danger. And we do need to let go of these things. So I was rather playful with him afterwards. I came to see him one night in the hospital and he couldn't talk. And so I thought, now's my chance. He can't talk back. So I came, he'd asked me to bring a newspaper. And he likes The Australian, which is a really conservative newspaper in Australia. And so I brought him that paper because he'd asked, but then I brought him another newspaper. And I gave it to him and I said, because I'm much less conservative politically. He's a gorgeous man, but he's awfully conservative when it comes to politics. And I said, now that you can't answer back, here's your paper. And I can't have you reading this one all the time, or you'll be way too conservative to be called my big brother. And so we had fun. And he laughed and laughed and laughed. And we spent a lot of time together and it was very, very sweet. So, back to my theme. Ajahn Chah, one of the other great teachers of Thailand, there's many, but he's another, says this about practice. The original heart-mind shines like pure, clear water with the sweetest taste. But if the heart is pure, is our practice over? No. We must not cling even to this purity. We must go beyond all duality, all concepts, all bad, all good, all pure, all impure. We must go beyond self and no self, beyond birth and death. To see a self reborn is the real trouble in this world. So he means when the I is reborn, the self is reborn with clinging. This is the real trouble in this world. And then he says, true purity is limitless, untouchable, beyond all opposites, all creation. And here's something that Pundit-ji wrote about emptiness, and I really, really deeply agree with it. Some people say that in emptiness there's no love and no beauty. These traditions and teachers say that emptiness is empty of everything. This is not my experience. He says. Then he speaks about his experience. Love is the fathomlessness of emptiness, the very heart of emptiness. Arriving at the depths of emptiness, there is love and beauty. It is very beautiful. So when we see and know for ourselves the emptiness of self, the heart and mind, in its radiance, its natural radiance, shines forth. And emptiness is warm. Emptiness and love are not different. And then we meet ourselves and all beings in the heart of emptiness. And this is the pilgrimage from which there is no return. That's it. May we all realize and know for ourselves the pilgrimage which ends our suffering. May we be fearless in our inquiry. And may we walk the Dharma path in love and friendship.